He had hurt Sybil. You started snorting coke, too, or have you been crying?
Lena wiped her mouth with the back of her hand.
What do you think?
Hank stared at her, working his hands back and forth. This was more than a nervous habit, Lena knew. Speed injected into the veins of his hands had given Hank arthritis at an early age. Since most of the veins in his arms had calcified from the powdered additive used to cut the drug, there wasn't much circulation there either. His hands were cold as ice most days, and a constant source of pain. The rubbing stopped abruptly.
Let's get it over with, Lee. I've got the show to put on.
Lena tried to open her mouth, but nothing came out. Part of her was angered by his flippant attitude, which had marked their relationship from the very beginning. Part of her did not know how to tell him. As much as Lena hated her uncle, he was a human being. Hank had doted on Sybil. In high school, Lena could not take her sister everywhere, and Sybil had spent a lot of time home with Hank. There was an undeniable bond there, and as much as Lena wanted to hurt her uncle, she felt herself holding back. Lena had loved Sybil. Sybil had loved Hank. Hank picked up a ballpoint pen, turning it head over end on the desk several times before he finally asked,
"What's wrong, Lee? Need some money?"
If only it were that simple, Lena thought.
Car broke down.
She shook her head slowly, side to side.
It's Sybil,
he stated, his voice catching in his throat. When Lena did not answer, he nodded slowly to himself, putting his hands together, as if to pray.
She's sick,
he asked, his voice indicating he expected the worst. With this one sentence, he showed more emotion than Lena had ever seen him express in a lifetime of knowing her uncle. She looked at him closely, as if for the first time. His pale skin was blotched with those red dots pasty men get on their faces as they age. His hair, silver for as long as she could recall, was dulled with yellow under the 60-watt bulb. His Hawaiian shirt was rumpled, which was not his style, and his hands tremored slightly as he fidgeted with them. Lena did it the same way Jeffrey Tolliver had. She went to the diner in the middle of town. She began. You know the one across from the dress shop? A slight nod was all he gave. She walked there from the house. Lena continued. She did it every week, just to be able to do something on her own. Hank clasped his hands together in front of his face, touching the sides of his index fingers to his forehead.
So, Lena
picked up the glass, needing something to do. She sucked what little liquor was left off the ice cubes, then continued. She went to the bathroom, and somebody killed her. There was little sound in the tiny office. Grasshoppers chirped outside. Gurgling came from the stream. A distant throbbing came from the bar. Without preamble, Hank turned around, picking through the boxes, asking,
"What have you had to drink tonight?"
Lena was surprised by his question, though she shouldn't have been. Despite his AA brainwashing, Hank Norton was a master at avoiding the unpleasant. His need to escape was what had brought Hank to drugs and alcohol in the first place.
"Beer in the car?"
she said, playing along, glad for once that he did not want the gory details.
"J.D. here."
He paused, his hand around a bottle of Jack Daniels.
"Beer before liquor, never sicker,"
he warned, his voice catching on the last part. Lena held out her glass, rattling the ice for attention. She watched Hank as he poured the drink, not surprised when he licked his lips.
"How's work treating you?"
Hank asked, his voice tinny in the shack. His lower lip trembled slightly. His expression was one of total grief, in direct opposition to the words coming from his mouth. He said,
"Doing okay?"
Lena nodded. She felt as if she were smack in the middle of a car accident. She finally understood the meaning of the word surreal. Nothing seemed concrete in this tiny space. The glass in her hand felt dull. Hank was miles away. She was in a dream. Lena tried to snap herself out of it, downing her drink quickly. The alcohol hit the back of her throat like fire, burning and solid, as if she had swallowed hot asphalt. Hank watched the glass, not Lena, as she did this. This was all she needed. She said, "Sybil's dead, Hank." Tears came to his eyes without warning, and all that Lena could think was that he looked so very, very old. It was like watching a flower wilt. He took out his handkerchief and wiped his nose. Lena repeated the words, much as Jeffrey Tolliver had earlier this evening. "She's dead." His voice wavered as he asked, "Are you sure?" Lena nodded quickly up and down. "I saw her. Then, somebody cut her up pretty bad." His mouth opened and closed like a fish's. He kept his eyes even with Lena's, the way he used to do when he was trying to catch her in a lie. He finally looked away, mumbling, "That doesn't make sense." She could have reached out and patted his old hand, maybe tried to comfort him, but she didn't. Lena felt frozen in her chair. Instead of thinking of Sybil, which had been her mind's initial reaction, she concentrated on Hank, on his wet lips, his eyes, the hairs growing out of his nose.
"Oh, Sibby,"
he sighed, wiping his eyes. Lena watched his Adam's apple bob as he swallowed. He reached for the bottle, resting his hand on the neck. Without asking, he unscrewed the cap and poured Lena another drink. This time the dark liquid nearly touched the rim. More time passed, then Hank blew his nose loudly, patting at his eyes with the handkerchief.
"I can't see anyone trying to kill her."
His hand shook even more as he folded the handkerchief over and over.
"It doesn't make sense," he mumbled. "You, I could understand."
"Thanks a lot." This was sufficient enough to spark Hank's irritation.
"I mean because of the job you do. Now get that damn chip off your shoulder."
Lena did not comment. This was a familiar order. He put his palms down on the desk, fixing Lena with a stare.
"Where were you when this happened?"
Lena tossed back the drink, not feeling the burn so much this time. When she returned the glass to the desk, Hank was still staring at her. She mumbled,
"Macon." "Was it some sort of hate crime then?"
Lena reached over, picking up the bottle.
"I don't know. Maybe."
The whiskey gurgled in the bottle as she poured.
"Maybe he picked her because she was gay. Maybe he picked her because she was blind."
Lena gave a sideways glance, catching his pained reaction to this. She decided to expound upon her speculation. "Rapists tend to pick women they think they can control, Hank. She was an easy target."
"So this all comes back to me."
"I didn't say that." He grabbed the bottle.
"Right,"
he snapped, dropping the half-empty bottle back into its box. His tone was angry now, back to the nuts and bolts. Like Lena, Hank was never comfortable with the emotional side of things. Sybil had often said that the main reason Hank and Lena never got along was that they were too much alike. Sitting there with Hank, absorbing his grief and anger as it filled the tiny shed, Lena realized that Sybil was right. She was looking at herself in 20 years, and there was nothing she could do to stop it. Hank asked, "Have you talked to Nan?"
"Yeah."
"We've got to plan the service," he said, picking up the pen and drawing a box on his desk calendar. At the top, he wrote the word, "Funeral," in all caps.
"Is there somebody in Grant you think would do a good job?"
He waited for her response, then added,
"I mean, most of her friends were there."
"What?" Lena asked. The glass paused at her lips. "What are you talking about?"
"Lee, we've got to make arrangements. We've got to take care of Sibby."
Lena finished the drink. When she looked at Hank, his features were blurred. As a matter of fact, the whole room was blurred. She had the sensation of being on a roller coaster, and her stomach reacted accordingly. Lena put her hand to her mouth, fighting the urge to be sick. Hank had probably seen her expression many times before, most likely in the mirror. He was beside her, holding a trash can under her chin, just as she lost the battle. Tuesday. Chapter 7. Sarah leaned over the kitchen sink in her parents' house, using her father's wrench to loosen the faucet. She had spent most of the evening in the morgue, performing Sybil Adams' autopsy. Going back to a dark house, sleeping alone, had not been something she wanted to do. Add to that Jeffrey's last threat on her answering machine to come by her house, and Sarah did not really have a choice as to where she slept last night. Except for sneaking in to pick up the dogs, she had not even bothered to change out of her scrubs. She wiped sweat from her forehead, glancing at the clock on the coffee maker. It was 6:30 in the morning, and she had slept all of 2 hours. Every time she closed her eyes, she thought of Sybil Adams sitting on the toilet, blind to what was happening to her, feeling everything her attacker was doing. On the plus side, short of some type of family catastrophe, there was no way in hell today could possibly be as bad as yesterday. Kathy Linton walked into the kitchen, opened a cabinet, and took down a coffee cup before she noticed her oldest daughter standing beside her.
"What are you doing?"
Sarah slid a new washer over the threaded bolt. The faucet was leaking.
"Two plumbers in the family," Kathy complained, pouring herself a cup of coffee. "And my daughter the doctor ends up fixing the leaky faucet."
Sarah smiled, putting her shoulder behind the wrench. The Lintons were a plumbing family, and Sarah had spent most of her summers during school working alongside her father, snaking drains and welding pipe. Sometimes she thought the only reason she had finished high school a year early and worked through summers getting her undergrad degree was so she would not have to poke around spider-infested crawl spaces with her father. Not that she didn't love her father, but unlike Tessa, Sarah's fear of spiders could not be overcome. Kathy slid onto the kitchen stool.
"Did you sleep here last night?"
"Yeah," Sarah answered, washing her hands. She turned off the faucet, smiling when it didn't leak. The sense of accomplishment lifted some of the weight off her shoulders. Kathy smiled her approval.
"If that medical thing doesn't work out, at least you'll have plumbing to fall back on."
"You know, that's what Daddy told me when he drove me to college the first day."
"I know," Kathy said. "I could have killed him."
She took a sip of coffee, eyeing Sarah over the rim of the cup.
"Why didn't you go home?"
"I worked late and I just wanted to come here. Is that okay?"
"Of course it's okay," Kathy said, tossing Sarah a towel. "Don't be ridiculous."
Sarah dried her hands. "I hope I didn't wake you when I came in."
"Not me," Kathy answered. "Why didn't you sleep with Tess?"
Sarah made herself busy straightening the towel on the rack. Tessa lived in a two-bedroom apartment over the garage. In the last few years, there had been nights when Sarah had not wanted to sleep alone in her own house.
She generally stayed with her sister rather than risk waking her father, who, invariably, wanted to discuss at great length what was troubling her. Sarah answered, "I didn't want to bother her."
"Oh, bullshit," Kathy laughed. "Good Lord, Sarah, nearly $250,000 to that college, and they didn't teach you to lie better than that."
Sarah took down her favorite mug and poured herself some coffee. "Maybe you should have sent me to law school instead." Kathy crossed her legs, frowning. She was a small woman who kept herself trim by doing yoga. Her blonde hair and blue eyes had skipped over Sarah and been passed on to Tessa. Except for their matching temperaments, anyone would be hard-pressed to tell that Kathy and Sarah were mother and daughter.
"Well?" Kathy prompted.
Sarah couldn't keep the smile off of her lips. "Let's just say Tess was a little busy when I walked in and leave it at that."
"Busy by herself?"
"No," Sarah barked an uncomfortable laugh, feeling her cheeks turn red. "God, Mother." After a few moments, Kathy lowered her voice, asking, "Was it Devon Lockwood?"
"Devon?"
Sarah was surprised by the name. She hadn't been able to see exactly who Tessa was wrangling around with in bed, but Devon Lockwood, the new plumber's helper Eddie Linton had hired 2 weeks ago, was the last name she was expecting to come up. Kathy shushed her.
"Your father will hear."
"Hear what?"
Eddie asked, shuffling into the kitchen. His eyes lit up when he saw Sarah.
"There's my baby,"
he said, kissing her cheek with a loud smack.
"Was that you I heard coming in this morning?"
"That was me," Sarah confessed.
"I got some paint chips in the garage," he offered. "Maybe we can go look at them after we eat, pick a pretty color for your room."
Sarah sipped her coffee. "I'm not moving back in, Dad." He jabbed a finger at the cup.
"That'll stunt your growth."
"I should be so lucky," Sarah grumbled. Since the ninth grade, she had been the tallest member of her immediate family, just inching past her father by a hair. Sarah slid onto the stool her mother vacated. She watched her parents as they went through their morning routine, her father walking around the kitchen, getting in her mother's way until Kathy pushed him into a chair. Her father smoothed his hair back as he leaned over the morning paper. His salt-and-pepper hair stuck out in three different directions, much like his eyebrows. The T-shirt he was wearing was so old that worn holes were breaking through over his shoulder blades. The pattern on his pajama pants had faded out over 5 years ago, and his bedroom slippers were falling apart at the heels. That she had inherited her mother's cynicism and her father's sense of dress was something Sarah would never forgive them for. Eddie said,
"I see the Observer's milking this thing for every penny."
Sarah glanced at the headline of Grant's local paper. It read, "College Professor Slain in Grizzly Attack."
"What's it say?"
Sarah asked before she could stop herself. He traced his finger down the page as he read,
"Sybil Adams, a professor at GIT was savagely beaten to death yesterday at the Grant filling station. Local police are baffled. Police Chief Jeffrey Tolliver..."
Eddie stopped, muttering,
"The bastard,"
under his breath.
"Reports they are exploring every possible lead in order to bring the young professor's murderer to justice."
"She wasn't beaten to death," Sarah said, knowing that the punch to Sybil Adams' face had not killed her. Sarah gave an involuntary shudder as she recalled the physical findings during the autopsy. Eddie seemed to notice her reaction. He said,
"Was anything else done to her?"
Sarah was surprised her father had asked this. Normally, her family went out of their way not to ask questions about that side of Sarah's life. She had felt from the beginning that they were all more than a little uncomfortable with her part-time job. Sarah asked,
"Like what?"
before she got her father's meaning. Kathy looked up from mixing the pancake batter, a look of trepidation on her face. Tessa burst into the kitchen, popping the swinging door on its hinge, obviously expecting to find Sarah alone. Her mouth opened in a perfect O. Kathy, standing at the stove, making pancakes, tossed over her shoulder, "Good morning, sunshine." Tessa kept her head down, making a beeline for the coffee.
"Sleep well?" Eddie asked.
"Like a baby," Tessa returned, kissing the top of his head. Kathy waved her spatula in Sarah's direction. "You could learn from your sister." Tessa had the common sense to ignore this comment. She opened the French door leading to the deck and jerked her head outside, indicating Sarah should follow. Sarah did as she was told, holding her breath until the door was closed firmly behind her. She whispered, "Devin Lockwood?" "I still haven't told them about your date with Jeb," Tessa countered. Sarah pressed her lips together, silently agreeing to the truce. Tessa tucked one of her legs underneath her as she sat on the porch swing. "What were you doing out so late?" "I was at the morgue," Sarah answered, sitting beside her sister. She rubbed her arms, fighting the early morning chill. Sarah was still in her scrubs and a thin white T-shirt, hardly enough for the temperature. "I needed to check some things. Lena..." She stopped herself, not sure she could tell Tessa what had happened with Lena Adams in the morgue last night. The accusation still stung, even though Sarah knew it was Lena's grief talking. She said, "I wanted to get it over with, you know?" All mirth had left Tessa's features. "Did you find anything?" "I faxed a report to Jeffrey. I think it's going to help him get some solid leads." She stopped, making sure she had Tessa's attention. "Listen, Tessie. Be careful, okay? I mean, keep the doors locked. Don't go out alone, that kind of thing."
"Yeah."
Tessa squeezed her hand.
"Okay, sure.
I mean..." Sarah stopped, not wanting to terrify her sister, but not wanting to put her in danger either. "You're both the same age, you and Sybil. Do you see what I'm getting at?"
"Yeah,"
Tessa answered, but it was obvious she did not want to talk about it. Sarah couldn't blame her sister. Knowing in intimate detail what had happened to Sybil Adams, Sarah was finding it hard to get through the day.
"I put the postcard," Tessa began, but Sarah stopped her.
"I found it in my briefcase," she said. "Thanks."
"Yeah,"
Tessa said, a stillness to her voice. Sarah stared out at the lake, not thinking about the postcard, not thinking about Sybil Adams, or Jeffrey, or anything. There was something so peaceful about the water that, for the first time in weeks, Sarah felt herself relax. If she squinted her eyes, she could see the dock at the back of her own house. It had a covered boathouse, a small, floating, barn-like structure, like most of the docks on the lake. She imagined herself sitting in one of the deck chairs, sipping a margarita, reading a trashy novel. Why she pictured herself doing this, Sarah did not know. She seldom had time to sit lately. She did not like the taste of alcohol, and at the end of the day, she was nearly cross-eyed from reading patient charts, pediatric journals, and forensic field manuals. Tessa interrupted her thoughts.
"I guess you didn't get much sleep last night."
Sarah shook her head as she leaned against her sister's shoulder. "How was it being around Jeffrey yesterday?"
"I wish I could take a pill and forget all about him."
Tessa raised her arm, putting it around Sarah's shoulders.
"Is that why you couldn't sleep?"
Sarah sighed, closing her eyes.
"I don't know. I was just thinking about Sybil, about Jeffrey."
2 years is a long time to carry a torch for somebody," Tessa said. "If you really want to get over him, then you need to start dating." She stopped Sarah's protest. "I mean real dates, where you don't drop the guy as soon as he gets close." Sarah sat up, pulling her knees to her chest. She knew what her sister was suggesting.
I'm not like you. I can't just sleep around.
Tessa didn't take offense at this. Sarah had not expected her to. That Tessa Linton enjoyed an active sex life was pretty much known to everyone in town but their father.
I was just 16 when Steve and I got together, Sarah began, referring to her first serious boyfriend.
Then, well, you know what happened in Atlanta,
Tessa nodded.
Jeffrey made me like sex. I mean, for the first time in my life, I felt like a complete person.
She clenched her fists, as if she could hold on to that feeling.
You have no idea what that meant to me, to be suddenly awake after all those years of focusing on school and work and not seeing anybody or having any kind of life.
Tessa was quiet, letting Sarah talk.
I remember our first date, she continued. He was driving me back to the house in the rain, and he stopped the car all of a sudden. I thought it was a joke because we'd both been talking about how much we liked to walk in the rain just a few minutes earlier. But he left the lights on, and he got out of the car. Sarah closed her eyes. Seeing Jeffrey standing in the rain, his coat collar turned up to the cold. There was a cat in the road. It had been hit, and it was obviously dead.
Tessa was silent, waiting.
And? She prompted.
And he picked it up and moved it out of the road so that no one else would hit it.
Tessa couldn't hide her shock.
He picked it up?
Yeah. Sarah smiled fondly at the memory. He didn't want anyone else to hit it.
He touched a dead cat?
Sarah laughed at her reaction. I never told you that before.
I think I'd remember.
Sarah sat back in the swing, using her foot to keep it steady.
The thing was, at dinner he told me how much he hates cats. And here he was, stopping in the middle of the road in the dark, in the rain, to move the cat out of the road so that no one else would hit it.
Tessa could not mask her distaste.
Then he got back in the car with dead cat hands?
I drove because he didn't want to touch anything.
Tessa wrinkled her nose.
Is this the part where it gets romantic because I'm feeling slightly sick to my stomach?
Sarah gave her a sideways glance.
I drove him back to the house, and of course he had to come in to wash his hands.
Sarah laughed.
His hair was all wet from the rain, and he kept his hands up like he was a surgeon who didn't want to mess up his scrub.
Sarah held her arms in the air, palms facing back, to illustrate.
And
I took him into the kitchen to wash his hands because that's where the antibacterial soap is, and he couldn't squeeze the bottle without contaminating it, so I squeezed it for him.
She sighed heavily.
And he was leaning over the sink, washing his hands. Then I was lathering up his hands for him, and they felt so strong and warm. And he's always so goddamn sure of himself that he just looked up and kissed me right on the lips, without any hesitation. Like he knew all along that while I was touching his hands, all I could think about was how it would feel to have his hands on me, touching me.
Tessa waited until she was finished, then said,
Except for the dead cat part, that's the most romantic story I've ever heard.
Well, Sarah stood, walking over to the deck railing.
I'm sure he makes all his girlfriends feel special. That's one thing he's very good at, I guess.
Sarah, you'll never understand that sex is different for some people. Sometimes it's just fucking.
She paused.
Sometimes it's just a way to get some attention.
He certainly got my attention.
He still loves you.
Sarah turned, sitting on the railing.
He only wants me back because he lost me.
If you were really serious about getting him out of your life, Tessa began, then you would quit your job with the county.
Sarah opened her mouth to respond, but she could not think of how to tell her sister that some days her county work was the only thing that kept her sane. There were only so many sore throats and earaches Sarah could take before her mind started to go numb. To give up her job as coroner would be giving up a part of her life that she really enjoyed, despite the macabre aspects. Knowing Tessa could never understand this, Sarah said, "I don't know what I'm going to do." There was no response. Tessa was looking back at the house. Sarah followed her gaze through the kitchen window. Jeffrey Tolliver was standing by the stove, talking to her mother. The Linton home was a split level that had been constantly renovated throughout its 40-year life. When Kathy took an interest in painting, a studio with a half bath was added onto the back. When Sarah became obsessed with school, a study with a half bath was built into the attic. When Tessa became interested in boys, the basement was renovated in such a way that Eddie could get from anywhere in the house to the basement in 3 seconds flat. A stairway was at either end of the room, and the closest bathroom was one floor up. The basement had not changed much since Tessa moved away for college. The carpet was avocado green, and the sectional sofa a dark rust. A combination ping-pong pool table dominated the center of the room. Sarah had broken her hand once, diving for a ping-pong ball and slamming into the console television instead. Sarah's two dogs, Billy and Bob, were on the couch when Sarah and Jeffrey walked down the stairs. She clapped her hands, trying to get them to move. The greyhounds did not budge until Jeffrey gave a low whistle. Their tails wagged as he walked over to pet them. Jeffrey didn't mince words as he scratched Bob's belly.
"I tried to call you all night. Where were you?"
Sarah didn't feel he was entitled to that kind of information. She asked, "Did you get anything on Sybil yet?" He shook his head.
"According to Lena, she wasn't seeing anybody. That rules out an angry boyfriend."
"Anybody in her past?"
"Nobody," he answered. "I guess I'll ask our roommate some questions today. She was living with Nan Thomas. You know, the librarian?"
"Yeah," Sarah said, feeling things starting to click in her head. "Did you get my report yet?" He shook his head, not understanding.
"What?"
"That's where I was last night, doing the autopsy."
"What?" he repeated. "You can't do an autopsy without someone present."
"I know that, Jeffrey," Sarah snapped back, crossing her arms. One person questioning her competency in the last 12 hours was quite enough. She said, "That's why I called Brad Stevens."
"Brad Stevens?"
He turned his back to her, muttering something under his breath as he stroked underneath Billy's chin. "What did you say?"
"I said you're acting strange lately."
He turned, facing her.
"You performed the autopsy in the middle of the night?"
"I'm sorry you find that strange, but I have two jobs to do, not just what I do for you." He tried to stop her, but she continued. "In case you've forgotten, I have a full patient load at the clinic in addition to what I do at the morgue. Patients, by the way," she checked her watch, not really noting the time, "that I have to start seeing in a few minutes." She tucked her hands into her hips. "Was there a reason you came by?"
"To check on you," he said. "Obviously, you're all right. I guess that should come as no surprise to me. You're always all right."
"That's right."
"Sarah Linton, stronger than steel."
Sarah gave what she hoped was a condescending look. They had played out this scene so many times around the time of their divorce that she could recite both sides of the argument by heart. Sarah was too independent. Jeffrey was too demanding. She said, "I have to go."
"Wait a minute," he said. "The report?"
"I faxed it to you."
It was his turn to put his hands on his hips. "Yeah, I got that. You think you found something?"
"Yes," she answered. Then, "No." She crossed her arms defensively. She hated when he downshifted from an argument into something to do with work. It was a cheap trick, and it always caught her off guard.
She recovered somewhat, saying, "I need to hear back on the blood this morning. Nick Shelton is supposed to call me at 9, then I can tell you something." She added, "I wrote this on the cover page for my report."
"Why did you rush the blood?"
he asked. "Gut feeling," Sarah answered. That was all she was prepared to give him at this moment. Sarah did not like to go on half pieces of information. She was a doctor, not a fortune teller. Jeffrey knew this.
"Take me through it," he said.
Sarah folded her arms, not wanting to do this. She glanced back up the stairs to make sure no one was listening.
"You read the report," she said.
"Please," he said.
"I want to hear it from you."
Sarah leaned against the wall. She closed her eyes for a brief second, not to help her recall the facts, but to give herself some distance from what she knew. She began. "She was attacked on the toilet. She was probably easily subdued because of her blindness and the surprise element. I think he cut her early on, lifting her shirt, making the cross with his knife. The cut to her belly came early. It's not deep enough for full penetration. I think he inserted his penis more to defile her than anything else. He then raped her vaginally, which would explain the excrement I found there. I'm not sure if he climaxed. I don't imagine climax would be the issue for him."
"You think it's more about defiling her?"
She shrugged. Many rapists had some sort of sexual dysfunction. She didn't see why it would be any different with this one. The gut rape practically pointed it out. She said, "Maybe it's the thrill of doing it in a semi-public place. Even though the lunch rush was over, someone could have come in and caught him." He scratched his chin, obviously letting himself absorb this. "Anything else?"
"Can you clear some time to come by?" he asked.
"I can set up a briefing at 9:30.
"A full briefing?"
He shook his head. "I don't want anybody to know about that," he ordered, and for the first time in a long while, she was in complete agreement with him. She said, "That's fine."
"Can you come in around 9:30? he repeated.
Sarah ran through her morning. Jimmy Powell's parents would be in her office at 8. Going from one horrible meeting to another would probably make her day easier. What's more, she knew that the sooner she briefed the detectives on Sybil Adams' autopsy results, the sooner they could go out and find the man who had killed her.
"Yeah," she said, walking toward the stairs. "I'll be there."
"Wait a minute," he said. "Lena's going to be there, too." Sarah turned around, shaking her head. "No way. I'm not going to give a blow-by-blow of Sybil's death in front of her sister."
"She has to be there, Sarah. Trust me on this."
He must have gathered her thoughts from the look she gave him. He said,
"She wants the details. It's how she deals with things. She's a cop."
"It's not going to be good for her."
"She's made her decision," he repeated. "She'll get the facts one way or another, Sarah. It's better she gets the truth from us than read whatever lies they put in the paper."
He paused, probably seeing he still had not changed her mind.
"If it was Tessa, you would want to know what happened."
"Jeffrey," Sarah said, feeling herself relent despite her better judgment. "She doesn't need to remember her sister this way."
He shrugged. "Maybe she does."
At 7:45 in the morning, Grant County was just waking up. A sudden overnight rain had washed the pollen out of the streets, and though it was still cool out, Sarah drove her BMW Z3 with the top down. The car had been purchased during a post-divorce crisis when Sarah had needed something to make herself feel better. It had worked for about 2 weeks. Then the stares and the comments about the flashy car had made her feel a bit ridiculous. This was not the kind of car to drive in a small town, especially since Sarah was a doctor, and not just a doctor, but a pediatrician.
Had she not been born and raised in Grant, Sarah suspected she would have been forced to sell the car or lose half her patients at the clinic. As it was, she had to put up with the constant comments from her mother about how ridiculous it was for a person who barely managed to coordinate her wardrobe to drive a flashy sports car. Sarah tossed a wave to Steve Mann, the owner of the hardware store, as she drove toward the clinic. He waved back, a surprised smile on his face. Steve was married with three kids now, but Sarah knew he still had a crush on her, in that way that first loves tend to hold on. As her first real boyfriend, Sarah had a fondness for him, but nothing more than that. She remembered those awkward moments she spent as a teenager, being groped in the back of Steve's car, how she was too embarrassed to look him in the eye the day after they had first had sex. Steve was the kind of guy who was happy to set his roots down in Grant, who cheerfully went from being the star quarterback at Robert E. Lee High School to working with his father in the hardware store. At that age, Sarah had wanted nothing more than to get out of Grant, to go to Atlanta and live a life that was more exciting, more challenging, than what her hometown could offer. How she ended up back here was as much a mystery to Sarah as anyone else. She kept her eyes straight ahead as she passed the diner, not wanting to be reminded of yesterday afternoon. She was so intent on avoiding that side of the street that she nearly ran into Jeb McGuire as he walked in front of the pharmacy. Sarah pulled alongside him, apologizing. "I'm sorry." Jeb laughed good-naturedly as he jogged over to her car.
"Trying to get out of our date tomorrow?"
"Of course not," Sarah managed, forcing a smile onto her face. With all that had happened yesterday, she had completely forgotten about agreeing to go out with him. She had dated Jeb off and on when he first moved to Grant 11 years ago and bought the town's pharmacy. Nothing serious had ever developed between them, and things had pretty much cooled between them by the time Jeffrey came along. Why she had agreed to start dating him again after all this time, Sarah could not say. Jeb pushed his hair back off his forehead. He was a lanky man with a runner's build. Tessa had once compared his body to Sarah's greyhounds. He was good-looking, though, and certainly did not have to look far to find a woman who would go out with him. He leaned on Sarah's car, asking,
"Have you thought about what you want for dinner?"
Sarah gave a shrug. "I can't decide," she lied. "Surprise me." Jeb raised an eyebrow. Kathy Linton was right. She was a horrible liar.
"I know you got caught up in all that yesterday," he began, waving toward the diner. "I totally understand if you want to cancel."
Sarah felt her heart flip at the offer. Jeb McGuire was a nice man. As the town's pharmacist, he engendered a certain amount of trust and respect from the people he served. On top of that, he was pretty good-looking. The only problem was he was too nice, too agreeable. They had never argued because he was too laid back to care. If anything, this made Sarah think of him more as she would a brother rather than a potential lover. "I don't want to cancel," she said, and, oddly enough, she didn't. Maybe it would be good for her to get out more. Maybe Tessa was right. Maybe it was time. Jeb's face lit up.
"If it's not too cool, I can bring my boat and take you out on the lake."
She gave him a teasing look. "I thought you weren't going to get one until next year."
"Patience has never been a strong suit," he answered, though the fact that he was talking to Sarah proved that point to the contrary.
He jabbed his thumb toward the pharmacy, indicating he needed to go.
"I'll see you around 6, okay?"
6, Sarah confirmed, feeling some of his excitement rub off on her. She put the car in gear as he trotted over to the pharmacy. Marty Ringo, the woman who did checkout at the pharmacy, was standing at the entrance, and he put his arm around her shoulder as he unlocked the door.
Sarah coasted into the clinic's parking lot. The Hartsdale Children's Clinic was rectangular in shape with an octagonal room made of glass brick swelling out at the front. This was the waiting area for patients. Fortunately, Dr. Barney, who had designed the building himself, was a better doctor than he was an architect. The front room had a southern exposure, and the glass bricks turned the place into an oven in the summer and a freezer in the winter. Patients had been known to have their fevers break while waiting to see a doctor. The waiting room was cool and empty when Sarah opened the door. She looked around the dark room, thinking, not for the first time, that she should redecorate. Chairs that could hardly be called anything but utilitarian were set out for patients and their parents. Sarah and Tessa had spent many a day sitting in those chairs, Kathy beside them, waiting for their names to be called. In the corner was a play area with three tables so children who felt like it could draw or read while they waited. Issues of Highlights sat beside People magazine and House and Garden. Crayons were stacked neatly in their trays, paper beside them. Looking back, Sarah wondered if she had decided in this room to become a doctor. Unlike Tessa, the prospect of going to Dr. Barney never frightened Sarah, probably because Sarah was rarely sick as a child. She liked the part when they were called back and got to go into the places that only the doctors were allowed to go. In seventh grade, when Sarah had shown an interest in science, Eddie had found a biology professor at the college who needed his main waterline replaced. The professor tutored Sarah in exchange for the work. 2 years later, a chemistry professor needed his whole house replumbed, and Sarah was performing experiments alongside college students. The lights came on, and Sarah blinked to adjust her eyes. Nellie opened the door separating the exam rooms from the waiting room.
"Good morning, Dr. Linton," Nellie said, handing Sarah a stack of pink messages, taking Sarah's briefcase. "I got your message this morning about the meeting at the station. I've already moved around your appointments. You don't mind working a little late?"
Sarah shook her head, going through the messages.
"The Powells will be here in about 5 minutes, and there's a fax on your desk."
Sarah looked up to thank her, but she was already off, probably running down Elliot Felteau's schedule. Sarah had hired Elliot straight out of his residency at Augusta Hospital. He was eager to learn what he could and eventually buy a partnership in the practice. While Sarah wasn't sure how she felt about having a partner, she also knew Elliot was at least 10 years away from being in a position to make an offer. Molly Stoddard, Sarah's nurse, met her in the hallway.
95% blast on the Powell kid, she said, citing the lab results.
Sarah nodded. They'll be here any minute. Molly offered Sarah a smile that said she did not envy Sarah the task ahead of her. The Powells were good people. They had divorced a couple of years ago, but showed surprising solidarity where their children were concerned. Sarah said, "Can you pull a phone number for me? I want to send them to a man I know at Emory. He's doing some interesting trials with early-stage AML. Sarah gave the name as she slid open her office door. Nellie had put Sarah's briefcase by her chair and a cup of coffee on her desk. Beside this was the fax she had mentioned. It was the GBI report on Sybil Adams' blood work. Nick had scribbled an apology at the top, saying he would be in meetings most of the day and knew Sarah would want to know the results as soon as possible. Sarah read the report twice, feeling a cold ache in her stomach as she digested it. She sat back in her chair, looking around her office. Her first month on the job had been hectic, but nothing like Grady. Maybe 3 months passed before Sarah got used to the slower pace. Earaches and sore throats were plentiful, but not many kids came in with critical cases. Those went to the hospital over in Augusta. Daryl Harp's mother was the first parent to give Sarah a picture of her child. More parents followed suit, and pretty soon she started taping them to the walls of her office. 12 years had passed since that first picture, and photographs of kids wallpapered her office wall, and spilled into the bathroom. She could glance at any one of them and remember the kid's name and most of the time his or her medical history. Already, she was seeing them come back to the clinic as young adults, telling them at 19 years old they should probably consider seeing a general practitioner. Some of them actually cried. Sarah had gotten choked up on a couple of occasions. Since she wasn't able to have children, she often found she developed strong attachments to her patients. Sarah opened her briefcase to find a chart, stopping at the sight of the postcard she had gotten in the mail. She stared at the photograph of Emory University's entrance gates. Sarah remembered the day the acceptance letter had come from Emory. She had been offered scholarships to schools up north with more recognizable names, but Emory had always been a dream of hers. Real medicine took place there, and Sarah could not imagine herself living anywhere else but the South. She flipped the card over, tracing her finger along the neatly typed address. Every year since Sarah had left Atlanta, around the middle of April, she got a postcard like this one. Last year's had been from the world of Coke. The message stating, "He's got the whole world in his hands." She started when Nellie's voice came through the speaker on the phone.
"Dr. Linton," Nellie said, "the Powells are here."
Sarah let her finger rest just above the red reply button. She dropped the card back in her briefcase, saying, "I'll be right out to get them." Chapter 8. When Sybil and Lena were in the 7th grade, an older boy named Boyd Little thought it was funny to sneak up on Sybil and snap his fingers in her ear. Lena followed him off the school bus one day and jumped on his back. Lena was small and quick, but Boyd was 1 year older and about 50 pounds heavier. He beat her to a pulp before the bus driver could break them up. Keeping this episode in mind, Lena Adams could honestly say that she had never felt so physically ravaged as she did the morning after her sister's death. She finally understood why they called it hung over, because her entire body felt hung over her bones, and it took a good half hour under a hot shower before she could stand up straight. Her head felt ready to crack open from the stress in her brain. No amount of toothpaste could take the horrendous taste out of her mouth, and her stomach felt as if someone had wrapped it tightly into a ball and tied a couple of strings of dental floss around it. She sat at the back of the briefing room of the station house, willing herself not to throw up again. Not that there was much left she could vomit. Her insides felt so vacant that her stomach was actually concave. Jeffrey walked over to her, offering a cup of coffee.
"Drink some of this," he ordered.
She didn't argue. At the house this morning, Hank had told her the same thing. She had been too embarrassed to take anything from him, let alone advice, so she had suggested a different place for him to put the coffee. As soon as she put the cup down, Jeffrey said,
"It's not too late, Lena."
"I want to be here," she countered. "I have to know." He held her gaze for what seemed like an eternity. Despite the fact that any source of light was like needles in her eyes, she was not the first to break contact. Lena waited until he had left the room to sit back in her chair. She leaned to the bottom of the cup on her knee as she closed her eyes. Lena did not remember how she got home last night. The 30-minute trip from Reese was still a blur. She did know that Hank had driven her car, because when she got into it this morning to drive to the station, the seat was pushed all the way back and the mirror was adjusted at an odd angle. The last thing Lena remembered was looking at her reflection in the plate glass window of the Stop and Save. The next memory was the blaring ring of the telephone when Jeffrey had called to tell her about the briefing, practically begging her not to come. Everything else was lost to her. Getting dressed this morning had been the hardest part.
After the long shower, Lena wanted nothing more than to crawl back into bed, tucked into a ball. She would have been perfectly happy doing this for the rest of the day, but she couldn't give in to that weakness. Last night had been a mistake, but a necessary one. Obviously, she had needed to let herself go, to grieve as much as she could without falling apart. This morning was a different story. Lena had forced herself to put on slacks and a nice jacket, the kind of outfit she wore every day on the job, strapping on her holster, checking her gun. Lena had felt herself slipping back into being a cop instead of the victim's sister. Still, her head ached, and her thoughts seemed to be stuck like glue on the inside of her brain. With an unprecedented sympathy, she understood how alcoholics got started. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she couldn't help thinking that a stiff drink would do her a world of good. The door to the briefing room squeaked open, and Lena looked up in time to see Sarah Linton standing in the hallway, her back to Lena. Sarah was saying something to Jeffrey, and it did not look polite. Lena felt a pang of guilt for the way she treated Sarah the night before. Despite what Lena had said, she knew that Sarah was a good doctor. From all accounts, Linton had given up a very promising career in Atlanta to come back to Grant. She was owed an apology, something Lena did not even want to think about at this point in time. If records had been kept on the matter, Lena's outburst-to-apology ratio would be heavily weighted in the outburst department. "Lena," Sarah said, "come on back with me." Lena blinked, wondering when Sarah had crossed the room. She was standing at the door to the supply closet. Lena scooted up in her chair to stand, forgetting about the coffee. Some of it spilled on her pants, but she didn't care. She set the cup on the floor and followed Sarah's orders. The supply closet was large enough to be called a room, but the sign on the door had given it this designation years ago, and nobody had bothered to make a clarification. Among other things stored here were evidence, dummies for the CPR class the police gave in the fall, and the emergency supply kit. "Here," Sarah said, pulling up a chair. "Sit." Again, Lena did as she was told. She watched as Sarah rolled out a tank of oxygen. Sarah hooked up a mask to the tank, saying, "Your head is hurting because the alcohol depletes oxygen in your blood." She flexed the rubber band around the mask, holding it out to Lena. "Take slow, deep breaths, and it should start to feel better." Lena took the mask, not actually trusting Sarah, but at this point, she would have sucked the ass end of a skunk if someone had told her it would make her head stop pounding. After a few more breaths, Sarah asked, "Better?" Lena nodded, because it was better. She wasn't feeling up to her usual self, but at least she could open her eyes all the way. "Lena," Sarah said, taking the mask back, "I wanted to ask you about something I found." "Yeah?" Lena said, feeling put on her guard. She was expecting Sarah to try to talk her out of being here during the briefing, so when the other woman spoke, Lena was surprised. "When I was examining Sybil," Sarah began, storing the tank back against the wall, "I found some physical evidence that I wasn't exactly expecting."
"Like what?"
Lena asked, her mind starting to work again. "I don't think it has a bearing on the case, but I have to tell Jeffrey what I found. It's not up to me to make that kind of decision." Despite the fact that Sarah had helped her headache, Lena did not have patience for her games.
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm talking about the fact that your sister's hymen was intact up until the rape." Lena felt her stomach drop. She should have thought of this. But too much had happened in the last 24 hours for Lena to come to logical conclusions. Now the whole world would know her sister was gay. "I don't care, Lena," Sarah said, "really. However she wanted to live her life is fine with me."
"What the hell does that mean?"
"It means what it means," Sarah answered, obviously thinking that was enough. When Lena did not respond, she added, Lena, I know about Nan Thomas. I put two and two together. Lena